Dutch particles up the right-hand side. Let me assume that this is a vertically polarized dipole, and I'm making the top half of the dipole at this instant of time positive, and the left-hand side negative, by way of what I'm doing with my twin-lead transmission line. I'm launching positively charged particles into the upper half of that dipole, and they're traveling upward. Current is moving in the upward direction on the right-hand side. I'm trying to launch negative voltage on the left-hand side of the dipole. That means I'm subtracting positively charged particles out of the bottom half of the dipole, with the left side of the transmission line, if you know what I mean. Current, again, is flowing upward. It's hard to believe. When you feed the center of a dipole, the current, direction current flow in the upper half of that dipole, this vertically polarized dipole in my example, the direction of current flow on this half cycle is upward on the upper half. The direction of current flow on the lower half of the dipole is also upward. The current flow is in the same direction at each instant of time on each half of the dipole. That tells you what you really can do if you want to. Let me drop. You could, because you're making a vertically polarized, let me pick a number, 80-meter dipole. It's 132 feet long, and I want it to be vertically polarized. And I've got 140 feet of vertical tower in my example, and I've got this vertically polarized dipole mounted standing off the side of my 140-foot tower. This vertical dipole, 132 feet long, hanging from the top of my tower. And ordinarily, you would put an egg insulator in the middle of the dipole, 67 feet from each end, and feed the transmission line halfway up the tower, if you know what I mean. You could decide to do that. You could also decide, don't put an egg insulator in the center of the dipole, short-circuit the center of the dipole, feed the bottom of the dipole at ground level. Whether you feed the dipole in the center, 10% off to one side, 90% off to one side, or feed it at the bottom is your choice. It's a flywheel. The energy is going to bounce back and forth on the dipole 10 times before it gets radiated into space. It's a flywheel. How you launch the energy into the flywheel doesn't matter. You can have the push rod to the flywheel near the center, near the pivot point, or near the perimeter. It's your choice. Doesn't matter. You can therefore decide to feed the bottom of the dipole if you want to. Now you have no trouble understanding if the current flow on the bottom half and the top half is the same at each instant of time. The only disadvantage of feeding the bottom of the dipole at ground level is you're feeding 1,500 ohms instead of 70 ohms. As long as you're willing to make an L network to do a C impedance step up from 50 ohms to 70 ohms, it'll work like a charm. And Bell, K2KEY, did just that. Worked like a charm. And it's a lot easier to feed the bottom of the dipole. It takes a lot less transmission line. You don't have to run up the tower and do it. So the current flow in any dipole that's running at resonance, each half has the current flow in the exact same direction. Therefore, if you're going to use the right-hand rule on the bottom half of the dipole, you're going to use the right-hand rule.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
To continue, therefore, you're going to use the right-hand rule in the bottom half of the dipole and the top half of the dipole. They are co-phase current-wise. Since the magnetic field launched by your dipole is due to current, since the current flowing in the top half, each half of the dipole is in the exact same direction at each instant of time, the magnetic field of each side is identical. They support each other, and it all comes together out in space as if there was one single piece of wire there. The fact that you put an egg insulator in the center and feed it with your transmission line is really an extremely minor perturbation to what's happening in the radiating process of that dipole. And once you feed it from one end instead of the center and put a short circuit in the center, and it behaves in the identical manner, the exact same gain, the exact same effective capture area, the exact same pattern, you say, wow. Now I understand a little bit more about what's going on. KC2WGV, K2LIW.
Oh, very good, Dick. Yeah, I thought it was very important to explain that because I got a couple letters on that, and really they were totally confused. They would think that it was opposite, that one would be positive, one would be negative. They automatically figured the directions were going to be different, so the right-hand rule would be opposing, and not the case. So now that they can really picture that, and with wrapping their fingers around, they can see the direction of the magnetic field, and that gives them a good clue. Okay, that's about all I got prepared for tonight, so I guess we'll take it over to Paul, see if he's got a space report.
satellite reading for last week. I expected you to have more questions. And if the Paul gives his report, if you want to find another question, you can, John. You must have a little bit of a pile up there by now. Paul, WS2N. Hope you'll be able to get in through the Eastern Input, and maybe you'll get a space report tonight. WS2N, K2RIW. Go ahead, Paul.
Did you hear my water analogy? That's the way I think of it. With a pump. take a muffler for suction and discharge. You hook that up anywhere along the line of a pipe instead of a dipole. You know, you just have a straight pipe, and it's going to be sucking on one side and discharging on the other. But, you know, no matter what, that water is definitely going to be moving in the same direction. I'm just thinking of that as an analogy. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, I think that's a possible way of looking at it, Paul. By the way, as you were aiming your antenna, the last 5 degrees or so of rotation, the signal got a little bit weaker, back off a little bit, and your audio is just about right. Occasionally when the signal is not full strength, and the peaks of your audio give a little bit of a dropout, but I'm afraid to tell you not to back off on the audio. But do back off a little bit on the aiming. Back to you, Paul. And when you say water now, I guess you're assuming that water is flowing from the bottom of the dipole to the top of the dipole in my vertically polarized dipole. And so whether it's the current flowing or water flowing through it, the current is all in one direction. And by the right-hand rule, it's generating a co-phase magnetic field on each half of the dipole. WS2F.
KQRIW. Okay, very good. Well, yeah, exactly. I think of the water analogies for everything. Well, coming out of the steam fitter trade, you know, with pneumatics and water pressure and steam pressure, you know, everything flowing in one direction. I always thought the water analogies were great, you know, for everything. To deal with when I was first learning the anything to do with electronics, so that's the reason I brought that up. I moved the antenna, Dick, has this.
Fantastic. And by the way, I have my own water analogy, so if Glenn is available later on, I'm going to give him my water analogy. Mine's a little bit different. In my case, it's a basketball being cyclically pushed up and down in the middle of a lake, and you watch those waves spread out. And the way you analyze the way those waves in water happen from the basketball being pushed up and down, as opposed to what happens when you push the basketball down once and you try to measure one steady state magnetic field as opposed to a whole bunch of individual waves, makes a huge difference in what you're able to measure, what the sensitivity of the receiving system is. Glenn and I might get into that tonight. I'm not sure. But you sound good. You're in exactly the right location right now. WS2N, KQRIW. Tell us what NASA has been doing.
Okay, very good. I think I remember that analogy. You've used that in the past. I just wanted to go over a couple of things. I didn't have much tonight, but we discussed last week. Somehow we got involved in the topic of bringing satellites back on a space shuttle in the past. And I remember we talked about the Indonesian satellite that was brought back. I looked up, actually I have a post on that, besides the internet, and they not only brought one satellite back, they brought a second satellite back at the same time. A Westar, they brought the Indian satellite back, and eventually that one was relaunched. Rebuilt and relaunched, but the Westar was never really relaunched. It was some kind of insurance deal went over to somebody else, and they did that. And it's not the only time they brought a satellite back. There was a flight before that. Correction. That was a flight number 10 of the shuttle missions. Let me drop it. Flight number 11, they had brought up another satellite called the LDEF, Long Duration Exposure Facility. And this thing was like 30 feet long, 14 feet in diameter. And the idea was to leave it up in space for a year. And they were going to, had a lot of different materials all over it, experiments. And they wanted to see how the space environment affected all these materials. We're going to leave it up there a year and bring it back and then do experiments. Well, in that time frame, they had Challenger explode. So instead of this thing staying up 1 year, it stayed up almost 6 years. And yet they did have a shuttle go up and grab a hold of this thing, you know, 6 years later, put it into the back of cargo bay and brought this thing, this big satellite back, 30 feet long, over 20,000 pounds. I mean, this is what they were doing. This is what they had in mind for many, many flights. We drop it. So this was going to go on with military flights. They were going to launch flights from Vandenberg Air Force Base. They never did. I mean, they got as far as mounting the Enterprise, which never flew in space. They mounted to the external tank and a couple of solid boosters. Rockets out at California Vandenberg Air Force Base. Never was launched because, again, Challenger had occurred, and they decided to scrap all those missions for a number of reasons, too lengthy to really go into right now. But, I mean, there was a lot of reasons they canceled that whole project. $4 billion launch facility they had built. Let me drop it. And what happened last week, by the way, was I blended the two missions together. The mission that brought up the LDEF, the Long Duration Exposure Facility, what they did was they also dropped that off. They also were supposed to grab a hold of the Solar Max mission. It was something called the Solar Max. Was not operating properly when they put it into orbit. And that's the one where an astronaut went out and tried to grab a hold of it. He had a maneuvering unit on, and that's the one you see where he's out there actually trying to grab a hold of it. He's got the gadget that he tried to attach to it. It finally didn't work out, and they called him back in. What happened is that when he touched it a couple of times, it started to create a wild oscillation, and they thought about it, and overnight, Mission Control fired up these momentum motors on board the satellite, which eventually corrected the this out-of-control spinning of it, and they eventually grabbed the whole of it with the arm, drop it, the robotic arm on board the shuttle, and attached it to the cargo bay, and they went out the next day, another EPA did the necessary repairs that they had planned on in the beginning and let that go back in space. They didn't bring that one back. So, out of all the missions, they did bring a total of three satellites back. And at one time, it was planned to actually bring the Hubble back. Well, Hubble is four times more heavier than the Long Duration Exposure Facility, so all this stuff never really occurred the way they thought it was going to occur. I mean, they planned on 50 missions a year. It never happened. I think they did 9 in 1 year. So much for the year. But of the missions that we were talking about last week, just one thing I want to mention, Long Island related anyway, let me drop it. The Vanderbilt Planetarium is going to be opening up in a couple of weeks. They rebuilt everything. Multi-million dollar project to bring the planetarium up to par with some of the other ones, probably better than the other ones around the country. And that'll be opening March 15th. It's not supposed to be much, like, I guess it's not a commercial announcement, but I think it's well worth always visiting that place. That's the one incentive port. You know, if you come in on each, that's where you get off at exit 51, 51, and you head north. And of course, you can always get directions from their website, Vanderbilt website. So I thought I'd bring that up. And a couple other topics I won't go into, but unless you want to, I think. Back to you, WS2N.
Yeah, there's two things I want to mention, Paul. One is that you may have read a report that NASA is thinking of launching another Hubble-like device. What we've discovered is that there's a warehouse in Syracuse, I think it is, or is it Utica? I think it's Syracuse, where there is a Hubble class satellite, just a little bit smaller than Hubble, that was part of one of the military programs. It's a spare piece of hardware left over, and it has many of Hubble's capabilities. So there's a chance that that can be launched between now and the time James Webb gets launched. When it comes to what goes on at the Vanderbilt Planetarium in Centerport, Long Island, the Astronomical Society of Long Island, that group meets there essentially every single Wednesday, and I think it's approximately 8 o'clock. I was there about a month ago looking at listening to a presentation by one of their members. What happened a couple of months ago is that one of their members was given a ride up on the Vomit Comet, an aircraft that made, I think it made something like 30 separate, 30-second long, 28-second long microgravity maneuvers. And so this athlete member had some beautiful pictures to show us at what it was like. He had a dream, a lifelong dream, of putting out his arms and flying. And he did that in the in that NASA aircraft. And when you see him doing it, the crowd really got quite a laugh out of what I said. Hey, you're not using enough aileron. You weren't tilting your hands enough. So that's a beautiful aircraft to learn what weightlessness is like with your particular body 30 seconds at a time. And the astronauts that are on the International Space Station get to feel that for 6 months at a time. And it's got some interesting effects on human beings. So visiting the Hayden Planetarium, Hayden Planetarium also, but the Vanderbilt Planetarium in Centerport, after their renovation, it's going to be a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun even before. Their meetings are still being held there, actually, but not in the main planetarium building. It's another utility building on the Vanderbilt plantation, the Vanderbilt, what do you call it now, compound. And so they're a good group. If you have any interest in astronomy at all, and some of the LIMOC members do, they do show up there, and if you ever wished you had a refractor or reflector or any other kind of telescope, and you want to really use it in a serious manner, that is arguably the most serious group on Long Island, with a slight exception of the groups that meet out in Southold at the Custer Institute. Okay, what else was I going to ask you? To bring back Hubble, wow. That was the biggest, heaviest object. I mean, the whole size of the cargo hold of the space shuttle was made to just barely be able to accommodate this great big object called Hubble. And that's an extremely heavy thing. To bring that back, which, let me pick a number, it's almost going to double the amount of heating of those tiles during the air reentry, because you've got to take all of that kinetic energy of that heavy object and remove it by air friction. I call it friction, but you know what I mean by that. It's really the pressure wave in the front. But the bottom line is that the leading edge of your wing and vertical stabilizer are going to run really hot on that reentry. And as we now know, that was a slightly risky maneuver if everything is not in perfect shape when you're coming back. So to return Hubble, is it worth the risk? It's an interesting question. I think you've indicated in the past that on the very last mission, they added a fixture to the back of Hubble, which will allow them to do a robotic operation some number of years in the future, in which they'll fly up a craft which attaches itself and then does a deorbit burn to make sure that Hubble lands into the Pacific Ocean, as opposed to on top of somebody in Australia. So I wonder what details you can give us about that fixture and that structure, that spacecraft that's going to be built. I don't think that spacecraft exists yet, that deorbit burn spacecraft. WS2N, K2RIW in the TechNet.
No, it does not exist. I'm sure they have that on the drawing board. That probably holds a list for many more years. I mean, the last last mission out there, they put an extra couple of batteries in there. Carries, I think, four big, huge batteries. And they replaced two of them. And then gyros, I think there's five gyros on board. There were three of them that were faulty. If one more went out, I think they were going to lose control of it. And they got up there just in time to do that, and they replaced the gyros, whatever was needed there. And of course, all the electronics, we talked about that before, and that ripped everything apart, power supplies, things that weren't even meant to be changed. So they have a perfectly operating one right now. I don't think anything's failed. I haven't read anything that, you know, since a couple of years ago when they did that. And they did a picture on the bottom of the Hubble. Let me drop it. And they do plan on, you know, that was an important piece because it'll be much easier to send up a rocket spacecraft without a astronauts, and this thing will be able to attach itself to it relatively easy, and then fire its engine, and they'll be able to control exactly where this thing is going to deorbit, and that will be over the Pacific Ocean. That's where everything else gets burnt up to, all the cargo flights, everything that goes up. Pacific Ocean is the biggest ocean. It's the best one to shoot for. Chance of hitting land is pretty hard to do. And okay, on the Obama comet, I think that's the KC-135 dropping. And it does all those parabolic arcs. And we have a commercial one now too, for commercial use. There's two active ones, one by NASA and a commercial company is doing it. And what is it, 5, 6, 7 years ago, Steve Hawkins got a chance to do it. He always wanted to get the feeling of being weightless, and naturally he's a wheelchair bound. Well, they put him on a Bob and Comet, and they said he didn't want to come back. He thought it was great. He was able to move, you know, felt like he was moving around. The freedom was terrific for somebody in his situation. Back to you, Dick. WSQS.
Good stuff, Paul. There's another comment I was going to make. Let me think now. Vomit comment. No, it wasn't that. It wasn't the international... Oh, yes. As you know, we're coming up to another economic cliff in Congress. And if on March 1st all of that funding cutback is going to take place, it means that schools will get less funding. Transportation Security Authority gets less funding. The FAA gets less funding. NASA gets less funding. Let's talk about NASA getting less funding. NASA getting less funding implies that their ability to build that spacecraft that doesn't yet exist, that's going to marry itself to Hubble and do the deorbit burn, if that doesn't get done in time, and Hubble does do a re-entry on its time when it feels like doing it, and if it falls on Australia, Canada, the United States, Europe, wherever, if it falls on land because of a political problem produced on March 1st of this year, can you imagine the amount of popularity Congress will have if that happens for that reason? Think about that one, Paul. WS2N, K2LAW.
Yeah, that would be a nightmare for politicians and for anybody that's involved with this thing coming down on them. It's happened a couple of times. The Cosmos Russian satellite came down over Canada and had radioactive material on board. Canada wasn't too happy about that. And, of course, Skylab, that came down, and you mentioned Australia. That's actually part of it. Did wind up hitting Australia. Didn't kill any people. It didn't kill a cow, though. It took out a cow. But you know, it's hard to hit somebody from out of space with something, unless you're going to have thousands of things coming down every other day. But the odds of doing it, you know, what it was, three-quarters of the water is, you know, everything's water. The other quarter is land. So you got more of a chance of hitting water, but, you know, that's a 25% chance of hitting land. And then to hit land, you've got to find a populated area. And I guess that's getting easier to do as the population increases. I remember when I was a kid, the population was not 6 billion, it was, you know, 5 billion or something. Now we're up to, what, 6 billion? India had 700,000, now they have a billion. what are you going to do? Back to your WS2.
Very fine, fellows. You're coming through beautifully through that repeater. Okay, that's our space report. I think I saw something else that I wanted to bring to your attention. Yeah. Have you heard about this humble class of telescope that is sitting in a warehouse? It's a leftover piece of hardware from a military program, tiny bit smaller than Hubble, and I know that NASA is considering launching it to take over where Hubble takes off. I wonder if you heard about that one, Paul, and if so, if you haven't, I'll find that one again and send that website to you. WS2N, K2LIW.
Very good, Dick. No, I have not heard that one. I'll look into it. But there's so many different things. And NASA's always getting involved in something new. So, but if they're going to get their wings cut with the money, one of the things that they wanted to put some money into is this top future stuff. But there's a guy that really believes that, and actually NASA's going along with this guy now. They're going to give him some kind of support. He really believes that he could come up with a theory that might be able to be done in a laboratory to show warp drive. You know, the idea of expanding space behind a spacecraft and compressing space in front of a spacecraft and have it move along. You know, the idea of something like this is outrageous. But you know, NASA's always looking into the, you know, I mean, they're at the fringe, Dick. And there is some money being developed helping this guy out, using a small amount of lasers and this and that, but just to get the concept through. And this guy, Dr. White, using this guy from Mexico, his theory about warp drive. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, an anti-gravity machine and warp drive, great things to dream about, but we really don't yet understand what the heck gravity is. I mean, the Higgs boson, where in theory that's where mass is coming from, and so the amount of mass seems to create the amount of gravity. So does a boson somehow relate to gravity? I guess it does. Can we build negative polarity bosons that'll give you gravity cancellation? That sure would be nice to dream about. When it comes to really potent lasers, I believe the most potent laser facility on planet Earth is the National Ignition Facility out in Alamogordo. I can't think of the name of the location, but anyhow, they've recently done the experiment where they thought they were going to break even. I mean, the amount of laser power you put into a pellet of deuterium or tritium, and then you hope it goes into nuclear fusion and gives you more power output. They thought they were going to get break even. The predictions now were this was going to do it. Unfortunately, it didn't quite make it. And as I said, this is already the most powerful, potent laser facility that has ever been built. I forget how many zillions of terawatts are being launched at that particular pellet. And yes, they did get fusion, but nowhere near as much as they expected. So fusion on Earth is a great promise for producing a whole lot of power, but my goodness, is it difficult. What takes place in the center of the sun is something like 10 million atmospheres and 10 million degrees Kelvin. You put that combination together and you get fusion, you get a whole lot of power coming back out, converting mass into energy. And we can dream about doing that. And it's going to be tough. I think we've now, let's pick a number, 40 years downrange, seeking that one. And the good news, it would give you more power than fission and a lot less, if I understand correctly, nuclear waste products. And the raw ingredients for doing that, so to speak, are seawater. The deuterium and tritium molecules you've got in seawater. Someday. Okay, let's see. I think I've answered all the questions of the people who signed in. We got to each one of those. Glenn and I have been having a series of discussions on our, what we think is higher understanding of how a radio wave is created, how it radiates, how it propagates through space. And for the last few weeks, I have been challenging whether or not a transverse electromagnetic wave really has an electro component. Because all the things that Glenn and I have done here on planet Earth, let me drop, with creating an electric wave to do electromagnetic compatibility testing, to do susceptibility testing, we created that electric wave, that electric field, by having an upper conductor, a lower conductor, and either a charge difference or a voltage difference between them. And along comes this thing called an electromagnetic wave, and transverse electromagnetic wave, Maxwell's equations, and here we are, 170 years downrange, and everyone believes that in free space is a magnetic component and an electric component. And that electric component, how is it being created when there is no upper conductor, no lower conductor, and no clearly defined charge difference between the two? There are no charged particles there. You may think that the electrons are jumping off your antenna when you transmit. For all practical purposes, not a single electron leaves your antenna. You put all kinds of current into your antenna. Because of the Q of the antenna being 10 or 20, the current inside the antenna gets 10 or 20 times higher than the amount of current your transmission line issues. That in turn makes a magnetic field that's 10 or 20 times higher. And that magnetic field, I'm convinced, does the majority of the start of the transmission process. And I'm asking the question, is it not only the start of the transmission process, is it really 99% of the transmission process of what goes on in free space once that signal has been launched and it's a few miles away from your antenna? I'm stating that magnetics is where all the magnetics really is. And so Glenn and I have been having that discussion. Let's see if Glenn is available. KC2QIQ, if you're there. K2RIW in the TechNet.
W-A-2-S-A-Y,
calling. Let's see what Doug's got to say. W-A-2-S-A-Y. We haven't heard from you in some time. And how are those electrons treating you out there in Rocky Point, Doug? W-A-2-S-A-Y, K-2-R-I-W.
Hi,
Dave. Yeah,
the electrons are treating you pretty well. I had a question. It came up while you were in your space discussion there. If they can send a spaceship up to poke the Hubble into a path where it would crash to Earth at some predetermined location, why can't they poke it into a higher orbit so it can stay up there for another 15 years?
Yeah, not a bad question, Doug. Why can't we put it to a higher orbit? The good news is that Hubble is already at a very high altitude. I think the number is something in the 400 nautical miles. Your normal International Space Station, I think, is in the vicinity of is it around 219 nautical miles? I think it's 219 in that vicinity. Paul can get that better refinement on that one for us. And so the International Space Station is just barely touching the top of the atmosphere, slowly being attenuated a little bit. Therefore, on each mission where you go up there to bring up cargo, they do a little bit of boosting to correct for the fact that it tends to decay. Hubble is at a much higher atmosphere, so the rate of decay is much, much slower. If we completely left Hubble alone, I'm going to make a guess it wouldn't come back for 15 years, some number like that. So we've got some time on that one. It's not as bad as it sounds. But to kick it into Yes, it gives you longer life before it re-enters the atmosphere. That's the good news. But the way Hubble goes into its failure modes, where its gyros stop working, its power supply stop working, its detectors stop working, at some particular point, Hubble becomes a hell of a lot closer to useless as a piece of waste hardware. And to have it sitting there as a piece of space junk at a slightly higher altitude is not good, because it still represents a hazard. We've got a couple of thousand things in space right now. And when you do a launch today, you got to check with NORAD and find out the exact location of every one of those 2,000 pieces of major hardware, and a hell of a lot of probably 10,000 smaller pieces of space shields and things like that that got jettisoned during the launching process, and gloves that got dropped by astronauts, and cameras that got dropped by astronauts. There's a heck of a lot of nuts and bolts and other stuff flying in space. And NORAD tries to keep track of all of that. You've got to keep track of where everything is at the instant that you do your launch. So allow something as big as Hubble to sit there as a hazard is not so pleasant. When you put things in the true graveyard, higher than synchronous orbit, where essentially nothing else is going to go out there, that's a safe graveyard. But anything in between Earth and synchronous orbit, 22,300 miles up, represents a hazard to some one of your spacecraft or some future launch. So just putting it into a slightly higher orbit where it lasts longer before re-entry, it's a partial solution, but it's far from an ideal solution. That's the way I see it, Doug. Paul, if you're still available, correct me on what is the number of miles of altitude of International Space Station and the Hubble Space Telescope, if you happen to know. WS2N, K2RIW in the second.
Yeah, it's pretty circular. It's not much of an aptitude, power to you. I think it's around 220 or something. Nautical miles? I forget. I think it's something like that. I know it's 58.6 degrees inclination, and that's because of the, actually because of the Russians. That's how we got involved with that. That was, they launched all their missions at that inclination, including Mir. Mir was at that inclination, too. And so yeah, I think I know Hubble's a lot higher. And yeah, maybe Doug's thinking put into a geosynchronous orbit or something. But now one gyro left. They fly plans up to bring it down, no matter what, because then the thing starts to get out of control. Once it gets out, that little wobble turns into a bigger wobble. That's what will happen, and then they won't be able to grab a hold of it with a robotic mission once this thing is moving all over the place. So when things start to fail, there'll be a big push to bring that thing back. Back to you, Dick.
Very fine, Paul. When you study what's going on with things that you put into low Earth orbit, that is a manned mission, you're between a rock and a hard place. If you're too low, you're touching the top of the atmosphere, you decay real fast and come back to Earth. If you're a little bit higher than that, you're hitting the lower end of a very intense portion of the Van Allen belt, which has got a lot of radiation, and you're cooking your astronauts. So you try to choose a compromised altitude where you're low enough, not hitting too much of the Van Allen belt, but high enough where you're not hitting too much of the atmosphere. Hubble didn't have that problem. Hubble has hardened electronics, and Hubble's at a much higher altitude. That's the good news. When Story Musgrove went there to do the repair, and he spent a lot of time outside of the spacecraft, he got a total radiation dosage from the Van Allen belt, which was a lifetime dosage. In other words, his probability of getting cancer just doubled because of that mission. And he knew that ahead of time. He was willing to make that dedication because he had that much faith in that particular piece of hardware. So to mount a space station at a higher altitude is essentially out of the question. You'd be cooking your astronauts. So Hubble is probably, 300 and some odd nautical miles, 400 nautical miles. I know that the shuttle can not exceed 600. So I'm going to guess Hubble is something closer to 350, 400. What do you think, Paul? WS2N, K2LIW?
That's around 600 kilometers. What's that in miles? Six-tenths of that. I think you're in the ball.
Yeah, I'm just doing a quick calculation here. If it is 600 kilometers, that's 375 statute miles, which probably is somewhere around 320 nautical miles. So it is a hell of a lot higher than International Space Station, well into the Van Allen Belt, as far as human exposure is concerned, and you don't want to spend very much time there. And Story Musgrove did during that repair, and he really pushed it also. I mean, I think the portable life support system on him is good for something like 6 hours, plus there's an emergency pack that gives you another fraction of an hour. And he went, he exhausted the main consumables, went into the emergency pack. He was approaching 8 hours. The emergency pack ran out while he was in the airlock coming back into the space shuttle. So he went to the edge. Very well protected. A completely practiced mission. That whole repair mission was supposed to be two flights, and he squeezed it all into one flight by getting him and his fellow astronauts to practice over and over again every single move they made during every minute of every one of those spacewalks to do that repair. Once again, the Astronomical Society of Long Island had a presentation by Story Musgrove at the Long Island, I can't think of the name of the place now. What's the name of the place where he gave that presentation?
Did he go to Cradle of Aviation, Dick?
Give that man a cigar. My man went blank. My mind went blank, and I couldn't think of Cradle of Aviation. Yeah, Cradle Aviation Museum is where he gave a very nice presentation in that super widescreen theater, if you know what I mean, with his pictures of him and his youth and what that mission was like. And then we had a chance to talk to him for an hour afterwards and get autographs and whatever. Interesting character. Quite a guy. Okay. Doug, so I think you've gotten some of the answers of your fairly nice question. WA2SAY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
WA2SAY. Okay, I say I understand. Basically, you were telling me that the you could put good up higher, but it wouldn't do any good because it's failing, and the various bits and pieces of it wouldn't work anymore. So I guess that's perfectly logical. I guess, I suppose, if we had the money, we could send somebody up again to fix it again. But I guess we're not going to do that.
To really do a major repair of Hubble requires something like an International Space Station. And will the future replacement spacecraft be able to do that? In fact, that's a question. If my new manned launch vehicles, Paul, are so much safer to launch where you don't get chunks of ice breaking off the foam and putting a hole in the wing and causing the craft to fail on reentry. If our new spacecraft, manned spacecraft, are so much safer, do you see reason to believe that they would have the ability to do a repair of Hubble? In which case, because Hubble appears to be the most loved piece of hardware that NASA has ever produced. I mean, there are Hubble huggers out there that are just out of sight. They're going to make sure that thing lasts forever. We keep coming up with better power supplies, better gyros, better detectors. Hubble is getting better and better. So why can't some of our new manned spacecraft go up and do a Hubble repair 3 years from now? What's your guess on that one, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW?
Well, the only ones going up right now are China. We could cross them off the list. And Russia. And Russia keeps sending everything at 58.6 degrees inclination. Hubble's at 28 degrees. They can't get down that low. So that's out. Orion spacecraft by NASA. First manned launch, first test manned launch, no earlier than 2017. And that's going to be, you know, the test launch. Then there's going to be flights after that. So maybe by 2020, maybe they'll be able to free up some time to launch the Hubble. By that time, the Hubble is going to be deorbited. They'll run out of time. But there's no reason that they can do that with the spacecraft like that. Now, the Dragon spacecraft by SpaceX, that'll be ready within about 3 years, 3.5, maybe 4 years at the most. They might have a shot at that time frame, but they're not going to be equipped for that. They're going to be happy if they could bring astronauts up to and from the International Space Station, which we got it. Boeing might have a chance with the CST-100. They call it the 100 because they 100 kilometers. They consider a space to be 60 miles up, which is the same thing as 100 kilometers. So they gave it that name. That's going to be a manned vehicle to and from the space station. And there would be no reason that they would not be able to do it again. Maybe a little bit longer than SpaceX, maybe five and a half years at the earliest before they can get people up there. You've got Sierra Nevada, they come out of Colorado. They're building the Dream Chaser. They're going to be sending vehicles out of Wallop, Virginia. Let me drop it. Wallop Island, Virginia. That'll be their launch facility. That will be a very small-looking space shuttle design. It'll actually be able to land on any runway. You won't need a big long runway like the space shuttle had. You know. But at that inclination where they're taking off from Virginia, they'll never forget to the 28 degrees that they need. And I don't think that spacecraft would be designed for that kind of work. Again, that's just going to, as far as I know, docking with the International Space Station. And all these things will eventually be docking with the Bigelow Space Station, which would be a private planned space station in the future. So there's a future for all of these things, but not for the Hubble. Back to you, Ben.
Okay, so now I'm going to ask you to do some estimating, Paul. I have forgotten. What was the year of the last Hubble repair? Was it something like 2010, 2011? What's the approximate number of years on average between Hubble repairs? If we use that as our heritage, our past history, you and I can make a rough guess as to how many years we're going to have useful life out of Hubble. And maybe Hubble is going to last 3 or 4 more years. But that's not long enough compared to all of these manned missions you described. So it looks like there's a predictable amount of gap in time between Hubble's nearly complete failure and the manned spacecraft nearly complete operationalness. There's a gap in time in there, which is kind of nasty. So back to Hubble. Roughly how many years ago was the last repair mission? Your best guess as to how many years it's good for? And so, when is end of life of the current thing called Hubble? Will it take us out to 2017, 2016? WS2N, K2LIW.
Yeah, that was the flight with Mike Massimino from, I think he was from Oceanside, from New York, anyway, from the island. He was on that flight. And I believe that was 2008 or 2009, one of those years, I think. And now him and his crew, there was no plan on, you know, at the time of Columbia, when Columbia was fucked up over the California and Texas. And what happened was, you know, they did, It was in the works. Well, we're going to eventually have another repair mission, because there was a repair mission right before that. And then they scrapped it. That was going to be it for Hubble. They were not going to even set up a robotic mission up to even bring the thing back. There was plans of actually trying to build a robot to fix the Hubble, because they didn't want to send any more manned spacecraft to anywhere except the International Space Station. That's it. In other words, we want to go to the space station. We want, instead of this 50-foot robotic arm, they have a 100-foot now robotic arm attached to the shuttle. And that was going to dock to the space station. And but actually, before they even dock to the space station, we're going to use this 100-foot robotic arm, inspect the whole thing. And then, as you remember, they came up to the space station, and they would do these pirouettes, and they would photograph. They would slowly turn the shuttle, and from the space station, they would photograph everything and check on every one of these tiles. And that's how careful they were being. They were bringing up special glues and tile repairs, and in case they had problems. In fact, they did have a problem once. They had to do a repair attached to the space station. So automatically, that's it. Hubble is up. No more missions unless you go into the space station. This, at least that's a waypoint where we could maybe do something. If something's real bad, we could attach ourselves to the manned space station, you know, with the rest of the crew, and wait for another shuttle to come up to save us. I mean, this is the mindset. You might remember that. What happened was the Hubble was so important, like you said, Dick. Let me drop it. Movement to get this thing serviced, and all the astronauts, they knew the risk, and that's it. The guys on board that flight, I mean, it was like just multiplying Story Musgrave by five, and send these five guys up, and we're going to do it. If we don't come back, well, we give a shot. And that's what went on, and that's why chances of even having another mission go up. Even if you had a Boeing or a SpaceX, you know, Dragon spacecraft, I mean, you would need large, some kind of another satellite or something to go up to attach to the Hubble. And the only thing that was capable of doing that is the shuttle. You might remember what they did when they dropped it. They attached the Hubble temporarily to the cargo bay of the shuttle, and now you've got a platform. You can go out, you can do your spacewalk, do your repair work. You can't do that with these other vehicles. It's just, you know, it's going to be a service module attached to an Apollo looking spacecraft, this cone-shaped thing. You would need some other contraption attached to the whole thing. The cost is phenomenal. The engineering, you're almost building another shuttle without wings to do something like this. You would need some kind of attachment to this whole spacecraft setup to further attach itself to the Hubble. So have people flow it outside to work on it. So not going to happen. Back to that, WS2N.
Hey, you've just given us a couple of bad pieces of news, Paul. In fact, the worst piece of news you gave us, which is not obvious at first, is that because of the Russian launch capability, International Space Station flies at a 58.6 degree inclination of orbit. In other words, that orbit is that number of degrees tilted away from our equator. And Hubble is tilted 28 degrees. That's 30 degrees of difference in the inclination of orbit. That's the equivalent of a zillion miles. If you burn up every bit of the fuel you've got on the the shuttle, you can only tilt the orbit 3 degrees. And here we've got to tilt the orbit 30 degrees. So the possibility of blasting up to Hubble